Do you find that as an artist living outside of the city in a more rural area makes it a different process for you, because you get so much external stimuli being in a city environment as opposed to maybe in a rural area? It all has to come from you.
Well, I think it kind of all did anyway. You know, it's the only difference about living in the city is I was also in contact, maybe even more physically in contact with my friends. And we would discuss music, and I would get influenced more. Whereas maybe in the country, I'm a little bit more it comes basically from inside me. But even when I was living in New York, I mean, when I would sit down to try to write something, there I was, either with the piano or the guitar, you know, and it was still just me. It almost didn't matter what was out on the street or going on. And I remember Ralph Towner had a great comment about a song he wrote where some beautiful song he'd written, because Ralph writes many beautiful songs. And they said, oh, you must have written this song while you were gazing at the ocean or looking up at the mountains. And he said, no, actually, I wrote it in a hotel room in Detroit, you know. So it almost doesn't matter where you are. I mean, it must have some effect on you, but I haven't figured out what it is for me yet. I guess I'm a little more calm and relaxed than I was when I lived in New York City. So maybe my music's a little calmer.
John Abercrombie is our guest on The Checkout. Welcome.
Thank you.
The new recording is called Wait Till You See Her. And this is almost like a string group with a little bit of drums.
Yeah, yeah. This recording is specifically, although the way Joey approaches some of the songs on here was very unusual. He did some, on one of the pieces, there's a song called I've Overlooked Before, which actually is a shortened version of I'm looking over a four-leaf clover that I've overlooked before. I just thought that was kind of cute. I've overlooked before. Anyway, what he did on that piece, which starts out as a kind of a ballad, and then eventually works into a little tempo, and I take a solo over a certain structure, but he put these funny cymbals right on the drums. He took them and he turned them upside down and put them on the drums and played them with his hands, while he was also playing the regular cymbals. So created this other world kind of effect, because you had the cymbal resonating on the skin of the drum. So, yeah, but you're right. It is kind of like a string group with percussion.
John, do you feel like you're almost an expatriate to some degree, even though you're a citizen of the United States, obviously? I feel like you work more on the other side of the Atlantic.
Sure. For sure. I work more, but most of the bands I've had that have been my own bands have all been with American musicians. I go back to my first band, which was with my pianist Richie Bayrak and George Mraz. Well, George is Czech, but he lived here, and the drummer Peter Donald. And then my second band was with Peter Erskine and Mark Johnson. Again, Americans. Then I had an organ trio with Dan Wall, who comes from Atlanta, Georgia, and Adam Nussbaum, and now this current band, you know. Although this is probably the most European-sounding band I guess I've had, in a way. I guess you might say that.
What does that mean?
It draws more on classical influences, which I think is a little more... I always view that as being a little more European-oriented than... It's not drawing as much from blues and bebop and American music. Although the songs, I mean, I still feel like I'm a jazz guitar player. I think this music borrows a little more from European classical music and 20th century music, some of it, and folk music maybe a little bit.
Is it less about the rhythm and more about harmony?
I tend to think more harmonically from the get-go. I mean, the tunes usually evolve more melodically and harmonically, and then I figure out what kind of rhythm I'm going to put them in. So a lot of times when I write a song, I'll write it with no tempo. I'll just write melody and chords, like rubato style, you know, yeah. And I'll just play through it and say, oh, this sounds nice, and then I start to hear a tempo or a feel, you know, that could work with this song. So, but usually I don't write a tune in a tempo to begin with, which is interesting.
That is interesting. You know,
and Ralph Towner told me he used to write tunes, and he knew he had a good tune if he could play it as a march. And I never figured that one out. But But that was one of his criteria. He said, well, if it sounds good as a march, I know I've got a good tune.
That's like reading Emily Dickinson poems to the Yellow Rose of Texas or
something like that. Yeah, it's bizarre. But I tend to just, it's a slow process. I just sort of like write songs and then see where they're going to go, you know. And a lot of times the way I envision them is not the way they even come out, you know, especially once you get in the studio. Like that tune I'm talking about, I've overlooked before. I mean, that developed in the studio because we had never played it. You know, it was a tune that was sort of in little sections. It had a rubato section that had a little interlude, and then it had a tempo with chords, and then it had another little interlude, and then it went back to part of the rubato melody. I mean, it's not difficult at all, but it's, well, just the route that all these things take. You know, the route, I mean, which way you're going to go.
Yeah.
And so sometimes if you looked at one of my songs after I wrote it out by hand, I mean, it would look like demented sometimes. I mean, it would just have scribbles and it would have arrows going over here, and it wouldn't, I mean, it's not going to look like a computer program spits out this perfect, you know, readable, completely correct thing, and everything's exactly organized. It's just the opposite. It's just all like hieroglyphics, you know, and some of the tunes have to be really explained. And then I rely on the musicians to help me with that, you know. I said, well, how would you feel if, you know, what do you think should happen here? Or what kind of feel do you think this should have? Because I always find that the musicians, why have a band if you're just going to dictate everything you want them to do?
Well, and, you know, who's to say that you would write something for drums that Joey couldn't just, you know, do better?
Exactly. No, he can. I know he can do it better. And if I have an idea for a feeling of a tune, I always, of course, mention that. I say, well, this is how I hear this song going, and then we'll try it. And sometimes I'm spot on, and other times we have to pull it apart and try it different ways. It's quite a process, especially when you don't get a chance to play the music a lot. All these records, from the Cat and Mouse record to his Class Trip and Third Quartet and the new one, were all done. I think maybe Class Trip we had played some of the music on gigs, but usually they're done like in a rehearsal studio for about 4 hours. And that's it.
Do you enjoy the editing process? Not the physical editing of the tape necessarily, but just that what you're talking about, where you try something,
oh, yeah,
it doesn't work, you know, don't take it personally, but move on.
Yeah, no, that's fun for me. I mean, that's one of the parts I like, you know. I mean, it's just watching the thing take shape, you know, watching what they do with it, what I do with it, and then what we collectively agree on. And then when you're recording, of course, then you've got Manfred Eicher in the studio, and what his input can be invaluable sometimes, because he'll hear things that you just don't hear. I mean, he doesn't know what form you're playing on. He'll say, oh, but I think maybe this sounds nice here. Let's start here.
Yeah. Intuitively.
Intuitively. Sometimes after it's been recorded, you listen to a playback and, you know, you've got this idea in mind where here's where the melody starts and here's where it ends. But he might hear the melody starting somewhere in the middle of the melody because it just sounds stronger. And then he'll have ideas about how to put things together too. And then, of course, he's when it comes down time to mix the project, then he comes even more out into his element, and he's really brilliant at that. So you really, when you record with a quartet, you're really dealing with five people, and maybe six, because you've got the engineer, James Farber, who's recorded all of these records. And so it's a group effort, you know. What makes my job easier, you know.
When did you decide that you wanted to be an improvising musician, John?
Well, I decided I wanted to play jazz guitar. I don't think wherever I've gotten to, I mean, I did I think that's just happened. But I sort of started out just hearing guitar and music. And I think, you know, the early things were people like Chuck Berry and I even admitted Elvis, although Elvis was never much of a guitar player. But, you know, he had a good guitar player in his band. There was this guy, Scotty Moore, who could actually play kind of jazzy. Pretty slick.
Yeah, and Hank Garland.
Hank Garland was wonderful, man. Yeah. I heard him later. So I think when I first started hearing jazz guitar, I was just enamored with the sound of the instrument. And there was just something so cool about an electric guitar and, you know, playing through an amplifier and playing these sort of bebop kind of lines. It just really resonated with me. So I wanted to play that, but I didn't know what to call that, you know. And I didn't know whether... I mean, I knew the term improvise. I knew what improvising basically meant, I think. But when you don't know how to do anything, you have to sort of, like, speak a language. So I guess I would... To start improvising, I had to start taking things from other people, you know. I'd hear somebody play something, and I would copy it. And that's how it begins. You just, you know... So in the first stages, you're not really maybe improvising like I am now, but you're copying.
Yeah, mimicry is a good start.
Yeah, and that's how it starts.
And then you build an idea of your own off of that.
Yeah, which is what I always try to tell my students, too, is, you know, if you're copying something, well, then look at that thing and maybe analyze it and then try to write your own version of that. You know, come up with your own idea based on that as opposed to just learning that, because if you just learn someone else's, the way someone else does it, it's just sort of a task you've completed. You know, you can say, oh, now I've transcribed this solo of, you know, whoever it is, George Benson or, you know, John Coltrane or something, or I've done this and now I'll transcribe another, you know, and pretty soon you could have a whole book of these transcribed solos. And what are you going to do with it? You know, sit down and read it in the toilet, you know. I mean, to me, the idea is to learn these things, to make up your own version of it, you know. So, but as becoming an improvising musician, you know, I think when I started to play gigs, when I first started to play gigs, I realized that's kind of what I was doing. I mean, I was using a vocabulary that I knew, but I was playing jazz. So I was thinking of becoming a jazz musician rather than just an improviser. But then when I started to especially play with European musicians and I started to get involved with ECM, and I was and met Jack DeJohnette and Dave Holland, and we started to play more open-ended kinds of music that I wasn't used to, then I realized I had to rely on my wits in a way that I hadn't done previously. And now I have to sort of, I hate this phrase, but be in the moment, you know. I really did. I had to be more tuned in a way that I wasn't if I was playing, like, you know, You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To, or some tune that I felt comfortable with, you know, that I could just sort of play things that I felt safe with. Now I was out with no, like Charles Lloyd used to say all the time, he says, we're out here without a net. I always thought that was a nice phrase, though. Like, but when I started playing with some of the more open, free players, you literally are out there without a net. There's nothing to catch you. You don't have a song to relate to sometimes, or you just have a little snippet of a melody. That's when I found that I had a talent for, I think, you know, for making it up.
I always think it's very difficult to be able to, one, be listening, and two, be thinking about what you're going to do next, you know. You almost have to kind of split the brain a little bit.
Playing is kind of schizophrenic, but I think when it's happening at its best, you're not really sort of thinking about what you're going to do next. You're sort of just reacting to what you just did, and hopefully to what the other musicians are playing.
Yeah.
You know, and that changes depending on what atmosphere you're in. But when you're in a comfortable environment where everybody's sort of feeling the same way, you're sort of following your train of thought, whether you're playing on a structure or whether you're playing without a structure, without a net, so to speak, you know.
You have a new member to the quartet, Thomas Morgan, the bassist.
Yeah.
What's he bringing in that's new for you?
He's actually leaving things. He's taking things out in a funny way. I mean, he's leaving even more space. And now Mark Johnson was a very spacious, lyrical bass player, one of my favorite musicians in the world. But Thomas is like, even plays less than Mark. Mark had a sparse element to his playing, but Thomas takes that to another degree. It's like there's so much space in the music when he plays, you know, and you're wondering what he's going to play next, you know, and he's constantly surprising. I think the element of surprise is what he brings. He brings this sort of just leaving a lot of space. I think he's also incredibly lyrical because sometimes you don't think he knows where he is. This is especially during a solo part where he will say where Thomas is playing a solo on a particular structure and you're listening to him and you go, where is he? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he'll play this lyrical phrase that'll just like kind of, he'll be perfect, you know, and you go. And he makes me listen in a way that I didn't before, you know. I'm even, and that's the big part of all this music too, I think, whether it's structured or non-structured, it's just listening. I mean, to be a good player, you have to really be a good listener. And I think Thomas has got, like, he must have some kind of sonic radar or something, harmonic radar maybe, in his inside him, because he seems to be able to find things that are kind of uncanny. But yet it's not flashy. It's not like somebody who's going to go out and play a million notes and you're going to go, wow, man, listen to that. Man, that guy's really cool, you know. This is not like that. It's just you won't notice it if you're not listening. You won't even get what he's about.
Well, before I leave, John, I understand that you're great at doing some comedic voices, and I wonder if you'd share a couple with us.
No, for Gabby Hayes, I mean, I don't know. It's not one I do all the time. I learned this actually from a bass player in Boston who was not a very good bass player, but he was a great impressionist, and so he used to say,
"Hey, David Roy, Carnassard Buckaroos, how you doing, Roy?"
So that's kind of Gabby Hayes, you know. And then it's like when my mother used to, when I first started playing guitar, and I remember I'd be playing up in my little room up there in the, way up in the attic, you know, and with the cobwebs and everything all around me, you know, and she'd say, "Johnny, why don't you play something for your aunt? She just arrived." And I wouldn't play it. That was Boris Karloff.
Yes.
So I wouldn't play it because I didn't want to be told that, you know, asked to perform. And it's interesting that in the end, you know, that's what I do. I mean, because when you step on a stage and you start to play, no matter how cuckoo you may sound playing, or whether you're playing straight ahead blues, you're performing for people. You're presenting what you do in front of people. You're kind of like getting a little naked in front of people. And so it's odd that became my chosen profession, and because I do enjoy playing for people, you know, it's like I really enjoy mostly the music itself and what it sounds like and how my contribution to it. But there is that element of like there's something nice about playing for an audience, and especially when it's an appreciative audience. You know, you do get that feedback that makes you play things you wouldn't play when you're in a recording studio or, of course, by yourself at home. Thank you.
The new recording is called Wait Till You See Her.
Yeah. That's got tons of space. I mean, that's just... And I don't even remember where that tune, exactly where that tune comes from. I remember hearing a version of that tune when I was really young and first went to Berklee School of Music. And there was a guitarist who's still alive, I think, Johnny Smith. It was sort of popular back in those days. And he did a solo guitar version of this tune. And I remember when I heard that, I really loved it. And then I didn't think about the tune until like a couple of years ago. So it's amazing that these tunes kind of stay with you. And then there's a Miles Davis version of this, of Wait Till You See Her, on a record called Quiet Nights with Gil Evans. But it's very abstracted. Miles plays the melody, but the orchestration is really wonderful, but it's hard to recognize the tune, is what I'm saying. So when I decided to do the tune, I went back and listened. I found Frank Sinatra singing it, you know, and found just classic versions of it. The tune is written in 3/4, but we don't play it that way. We play it with no tempo. We just sort of go. Again, it's a rubato feeling. It's the only one that's like that on the record, but it's really nice. I really like it.
The John Abercrombie Quartet, you'll be performing at Birdland starting September 30th.
30th through October 3rd. It's 4 nights.
I'd like to thank you for joining us here on The Checkout.
My pleasure.